Good afternoon. I'm opening the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Tuesday, May 12, 2009. We have three bills on the agenda today, and we will be taking them in this order. First will be House Bill 2911, second will be House Bill 2371, and finally House Bill 2470. I'm going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2911A, and Lori, can you please give us a summary of the bill?
I would be happy to. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2911A in gross requires the owner of a self-service storage facility to hold the balance of proceeds for the occupant pursuant to a sale of property subject to lien. It allows the owner to satisfy the lien and recover reasonable expenses from the proceeds. It requires the owner to deliver the balance of proceeds to Department of State Lands. If occupant does not claim the balance within 2 years, it prohibits the owner and related parties from acquiring property subject to the provisions. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued, and conflict says good to go.
Representative Barton, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brent Barton. I represent House District 51, which is East Clackamas County. And this is actually my first time appearing in front of this committee this session. It's very good to be here.
Welcome, of course.
I also understand, serving on the House Consumer Protection Committee, I know these bills that you're going to hear today very well. I also understand that that House Bill 2470 probably is going to take up a lot of your time, so I'll try and be brief in my remarks today. This bill, House Bill 2911, is a fairly minor fix, and essentially closes what I would call an unusual quirk in Oregon lien law with respect to self-storage liens. Essentially, a self-storage lien is exactly what it sounds like. It's when a renter of a self-storage unit, for whatever reason, is not paying monthly rent to the landlord, and there's a lien placed automatically on the property within it, and how that is the process underneath that. Essentially, right now in Oregon law, self-storage liens, potentially, any windfall profit goes to the landlord, which is unusual in Oregon lien law, and also in the self-storage lien laws of surrounding states. This bill attempts to correct that and bring it in line with other law. With that said, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was rather short. I do have a question. As far as the landlord goes, lots of times he doesn't get his costs out of it, and on the odd time that he would get more, with this bill, it seems to me like that would cause a problem for the landlords in that they wouldn't recoup the cost of going through the lien process as a whole. And that, I mean, you're cherry picking out a couple people, but what can you do? Does this bill in any way make the landlord whole?
Madam Chair and Senator, I would say, and this is, again, this is not my area of expertise. However, based on, for example, the most other liens, usually in the majority of transactions, it is improbable that if the landlord were to actually go through the process, auction off the property, for the most part, I doubt they actually are made whole most of the time. Usually, simply put, most of the contents within it oftentimes simply do not, the value of them at public auction is simply less than the amount owed and the amount to satisfy the judgment. That said, there are exceptions. There are occasional times of windfall profits, and the landlord in any lien process, self-storage lien or tenancy of any kind, they are entitled both to the amount owed as well as reasonable costs of going through the lien process. Occasionally, there might be a windfall profit, and for whatever reason, and unique to self-storage liens, amongst all Oregon liens, the landlord would get that windfall. It's not true in any other area of lien law that I'm aware of.
Madam Chair, may I follow?
Yes, and we will have somebody else also coming.
I got a couple questions. So the thing is, if this goes on claim, my understanding is then the state gets the money. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Senator, I believe ultimately yes, it would follow. I believe exactly the same process, and ultimately would go, I believe, to the Division of State Lands, and I think through that to the Common School Fund, if I'm not mistaken.
Madam Chair, what is the logic that the state takes the money and not give them back to the landlord, so the landlord would be made whole over the, you know, the process of all the different claims?
Madam Chair and Senator, this. Essentially, this applies only to windfalls. For example, let's pretend for example, just to that the landlord lien or the self-storage lien is an amount of $1,000. Let's say. Let's further say that there would be that the transaction cost for the landlord to go through this would cost about $100. So, and let's then pretend that the contents within it were $100,000. Let's pretend there was someone storing gold in there for whatever reason. Clearly, it's an absurd hypothetical. The first $1,100, i.e., the amount owed and the amount to go through the transaction cost, it does go to the landlord. It's the windfall profit, the excess profit that would ultimately go to the state and ultimately to our schools.
Right, and Senator, I believe that's on page 2 of the bill from lines 2 through 4, that the owner may satisfy the lien and reasonable expenses. Questions for Representative Barton? Go ahead.
I got another. The last question is, what constitutes a reasonable return for the landlord?
Madam Chair and Senator, that's a very good question. This, again, because this bill only takes it into account in, it brings this in line with other existing lien law. For example, mechanics lien, tenancy, towing lien, all sorts of liens. Although I don't know off the top of my head, I strongly suspect that that area of law is probably pretty well established since this happens a fair amount, particularly in the other context.
Senator George?
Yeah. Thank you very much. I want to make sure I get this clear because I got something from one of my constituents. I want to make sure this is clear. If, let's say, for instance, they were storing some kind of hazardous material in the storage unit and you had to go through a fairly expensive cleanup process, if there was other things in there to recoup value, you could recoup your entire under the bill, and the way I read it, I just want to make sure this is clear, you could recover all of your expenses to clean that up. Under the way the bill is written, let's say for instance paint or something like that, you had to dispose of it in a way where you had to pay somebody to take it away, but they had some items in there that were of value, and you could recoup all those because they're reasonable costs, right?
Madam Chair and Senator, that is an interesting question, and I see what you're saying, and I have not thought of that before. It's my understanding that the reasonable cost, typically apply to the transaction cost of doing, for example, the auction and actually liquidating the assets to try and satisfy the lien. However, you're then asking if those costs include not just the transaction cost of doing an auction, but also of, say, maintaining the premises or restoring the premises to what they should have been. And that is a question, probably not specific to this bill. I don't believe it's at issue with this bill so much as an existing Oregon lien law. And I simply don't know the answer to that question.
Well, if I have a follow-up.
Yeah, we do have
okay. I guess we can have somebody else answer it. I think what we're trying to get at is that sometimes you don't know until you actually open up the locker
that's
in there and if you've got a problem. And so your lien may be just for the rent.
Yeah.
And then you find out that you have other expenses beyond that. And the way I read the bill is it would cover those expenses, that you would be able to recover those. But I'm not – I just want to ask you to clarify.
I see, Madam Chair and Senator. I gather you're anxious to move on. But
We have somebody here who I think can answer
wonderful.
These questions. So. Not that you're not doing
Mr.
a good job, Representative Barton.
By the way, Madam Chair, we're a little more welcoming on the House side.
Sorry.
Really good to be here, I swear.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony, Representative. Mike Calvaggio, you want to come on up? You're welcome to stay, Representative Barton.
I'm sure I'd love to stay. This is great fun.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer, and we come in support of this bill, and before I outline a few basic points, I'll try to answer a few of these issues that we've been investigating. I think unclaimed property disposition is an issue more in tune to the Treasurer's Office, as we are a trustee of that fund. Senator Garrod's question first, where does the money go? I feel it's a little misleading to say that the state keeps the money. The state does place the money into trust within the Department of State Lands, and the original owner or their heirs may claim that at any point in the future from 2 years from now to as long as Oregon is still in business. So that that would be held in trust to revert to the original owner or their heirs. With regards to cleanup issues of a particular unit, the Currently, the law states that when property is auctioned off, the rental unit owner will satisfy their lien, which consists of whatever the is owed to them by the renter. Presumably, a storage unit owner that was concerned about cleanup costs would work that potential cost into their contracts, and that would be, I believe, the statutory lien would apply to those costs as well. Now, just to go over the basics of the legislation, we're not really changing very much except for the provision, as the representative noted, that unclaimed money beyond the cost of the lien and reasonable expenses would, in this case, revert to the Department of State Lands, as I said, to be held in trust, as opposed to being held by the owner and converting to their ownership. We also, I'll address a few issues that are related to the bill. We've added a provision from Washington's statute that says that the unit owner or their employees are prohibited from acquiring ownership of those goods in the locker or unit. The reason there is that originally we omitted this section and clarified that the owner was going to be responsible for disposing of the goods in a commercially reasonable manner. We just sat down and discussed this with the Self-Storage Association and determined that the commercially reasonable manner language was vague and could hold them to a unreasonably high standard in the case of an unsuccessful auction. Would they have to then put every item individually on eBay? Would they then have to travel to an auction house somewhere, possibly out of state? And we decided that that was vague, and we would leave that out and give them the authority to dispose of items after an unsuccessful auction in whatever manner they found acceptable. Now, states that allow this as a trade-off have the provision that the owner is ineligible to receive those items. Otherwise, you could easily convert items to the owner's ownership with discretion and then sell them at a personal profit, thus avoiding the state statute altogether. California and Nevada do have a commercially reasonable sale requirement, and as a result, they omit the section that prohibits the owner from acquiring the goods in the locker. So it's a trade-off that we discussed with the Self-Storage Association, and they opted for the way that the A and Gross version of the bill is currently drafted. I'm sure that we would be happy either way, and I think the representative feels the same way. I'd also like to point out briefly that unclaimed property by the state of Oregon. It was brought up as to whether or not the money would go unclaimed for an unreasonable period of time and whether that was actually useful to anyone. The Department of State Lands does regularly give property back to owners or heirs. That has been returned to them years and years in advance. So far this year, they've returned $50,000 to owners that first reported in 2001. Last year, the total was up to $300,000 from owners that reported more than 8 years prior. So this is a program that does a fantastic job of connecting original and rightful owners to their property, and that's why that we feel that the unclaimed property from storage units should find its way into it.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Gerard.
Thank you. Why can't the owner of the facility do exactly what the state's doing? Because what I see is a huge money grab by the state. And you are going to be able to put some rightful owners with the property, but the owner can do it just as easily. And the money that you don't, you pocket. And that I'm trying to figure out the rationale for this, because the landowner, 9 times out of 10, is going to lose money on the foreclosures. And so you're not making them whole for the process as across the board. You're just cherry picking. One or two good foreclosures that there would be a positive cash flow on.
Yeah, of course.
Indeed, Mr. Suaggio, Madam Chair, that certainly came up not a moment too soon.
Sorry. Chair Bonamici, Senator Grodd, the question is, why can't the owner do what the state does in terms of connecting owners to their property? And I would suggest to everyone, or I would just let everyone on the committee know, that the state's Department of Lands runs a comprehensive website that is searchable, and anyone in the state can search for themselves on this database and find out if they have property being waiting to be claimed. Several members of the House Revenue Committee had property waiting to be claimed. Some of our congressmen have property waiting to be claimed, and I would venture to guess, I haven't searched for everyone here, but I venture to guess that at least one or two members of the committee have property waiting to be claimed, and I would submit that that's a more effective, at least one, more effective way of connecting owners to their property than what a single storage facility could do. Second, the point was made that the state would simply pocket the money, and I would remind the committee that the state never, ever pockets that money and simply holds it in trust. The way that the law is currently written, the storage unit owner would hold that cash for a period of 2 years, and if it was not claimed within 2 years, the original owner would have absolutely no recourse to reclaim that money at any time. When the money is given to the unclaimed property program, the state holds it in trust forever and remits that property at any point in time to either the original owner or their heirs. So I would suggest that the state would do a much better, more efficient job of returning that property than an individual facility.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes.
If I can urge the committee to keep the questions short.
Mike, I think what the senator was getting at was this concept that when most of the things that we do in unclaimed property are things that are like bank accounts and things like that, where there's always a positive cash flow if there's unclaimed. In the situation of these rental units, you have people who may foreclose on 10 rental units, and out of the 10, there's 9 of them. They just lose money like crazy, and on the 10th one, they make a little bit of money. And under this bill, what happens is they'll lose money in all 9, and then they'll break even on the 10th. And sort of the way the law works right now is that they make a little bit of money and then they lose a lot of money, so it kind of offsets their total overall loss, which is different than most of the money that we sweep into the unclaimed properties. If I'm not mistaken, that's what the senator was trying to get at. Any response to that?
Madam Chair and Senator, firstly, I would agree that is indeed what he was getting at. First of all, I would say that is a hypothetical. Presumably, and by the way, I do think it is accurate that in the majority of actually foreclosures and exercise of the lien, that it comes out at a net loss relative to the amount of the lien. That said, there are occasional times of a windfall. To the extent those balance out system-wide, that's an assumption that I just don't know if it's accurate, if they really do balance out system-wide, say, out of multiple iterations. Or indeed, let's pretend there is one particular windfall. That might just make one self-storage owner, unit owner, particularly wealthy, whereas others statewide, it's hard to say to what extent, if and when they balance out. I would also say that these kinds of liens are actually, again, this self-storage lien is just one of very many kinds of liens: towing lien, tenancy lien, construction lien, mechanics lien. And yet, only in this particular kind of lien does this quirk exist. Essentially, the windfall goes to the landlord. I think that to the extent the senator does make a compelling policy argument, this legislature, and for good reason, I would argue, has chosen to not balance the line this way. And I think that I cannot think of a particularly good reason why we should single out self-storage liens differently than any other lien in Oregon.
Just real quick, I got a constituent that brought these up. Michael, I think I sent these questions to you, so you can just kind of go through them. They talked about the fact that they take clothing to local charities and then trash and junk to the dump in Corvallis. There is nothing that would prohibit them from taking items that had no value in the auction house and taking them to charity. They would not be liable for any of that. Is that correct?
Senator George, I'm sorry, Senator Bonamici, Senator George, that is correct.
And as far as the cost of taking something to the dump, that would be part. You would expect that to be part of the lien, and they could recover that cost. Correct.
Senator Bonamici, members of the committee, that's correct. There is a provision for recovering costs of disposing.
And one final question then. This particular constituent takes the items to an auction house, which charges about 35% to sell those items, especially because they're typically low-volume items. That would be considered, though all those would be considered reasonable costs.
Senator Bonamici, members of the committee, I don't know what the traditional, you know, cost of an auction is. If auction costs are usually 1% and they're paying 35%, I think that they're be a question, but that sounds like it's market rate and therefore would be able to be worked into the disposition costs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. I have two more people. First, we'll hear from Patrick Tate. Representative Thatcher, are you here for this bill? Do you want to testify?
Good afternoon. Chair Bonamici and members of the committee. I'm Patrick Tate, manager of the Unclaimed Property Section for Department of State Lands, and I'm here to testify in support of the House Bill 2911. I give you a quick overview of our Unclaimed Property Program. It's pretty much a consumer protection-based act. The property comes in. We serve as a single point of contact in the state of Oregon for owners to come forward, search out property they may be due, and then return that property to them. Until they're claimed, the funds do reside in the Common School Fund, and the interest from that goes to help the K through 12 schools. It is true that we hold it indefinitely for the owners to come forward, and we actively do seek out the owners. Besides the database, we do a number of different outreach events. We have a media thing you may have seen recently. There was a Dateline NBC show that we were at least aware of, and we did some local TV along with that to try to get the word out that people, all they have to do is go on our website or give us a call and we can try to get their money back to them. Majority of the property we get is intangible, which would be like an uncashed check, bank account, so forth. We do get a little bit of tangible property that would be primarily safe deposit box contents. Once they're reported, the contents, we do hold them for a period of time trying to find the owners. If we can't, we do have to auction it ourselves, and the proceeds from that sale would go to the owners or their heirs if they come forward after sale. In this particular circumstance, we really do not see this as being a very common occurrence where, unfortunately, in most situations when somebody can't pay their rent on a self-storage, it's very unlikely there's anything in there of meaning to them or substantial commercial value. In those rare occasions where either someone passes on or there's some sort of unique circumstance where they do leave behind considerable items in a box, and they've gone through the owner's gone through the cost of sale and preparation for sale and so forth, and there is an amount left for that owner after satisfying those costs, then we believe the owner should have a right to get that at least the proceeds from those contents back. Again, we see it as being a very minimal increase for us. It's really more in line for us to be more uniform with the states near us who have similar laws. And I think the main thing is that we do see that for the storage owner, because we do our own auctions, that it is very expensive to sell the items and prepare for sale. And we're pleased to see that part is in there, that they should get back the reasonable costs of taking care of the items. And it is unfortunate that in most cases they're not going to be made whole by the selling of the items. And the question came up, well, if 9 out of the 10 are they're going to lose money on, and then they're only going to make money on the one. And that would be, I think, perfectly fine to put those all together if they were the same person that was involved. Unfortunately, we are dealing with individual consumers, and so I would be upset. I know if most of the people who report to us have bad debts of some kind, and if they said, well, we were going to report your bank account, but there was bad debts on our books, so we're going to keep it to offset those bad debts. And so that would be my comment to that, as it is indeed, unfortunately, and I understand their concern that they do lose money, but we aren't usually talking the same person that has 10 different boxes. It's usually separate individuals.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
And next I have, finally, Rick Curry, and then Representative Thatcher, are you coming up? Okay. Who's on first?
What's on
Representative? Hi, I'm Kim Thatcher, representing Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburg, and I'm here with my constituent, Rick Curry, and he's the expert. He's been in this business for a long time, and I figured he might shed some light on this particular bill and some of the concerns he might have. So
thank you.
Leave it at that.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rick Curry. I live in Kaiser, and I'm the and owner of Budget Rent a Space in Kaiser. We have 447 units that we operate as storage units. We began building and operating this facility in 1991. In the past 2 years, we've seen occupancies drop and the cost of doing business increase. In this business climate, we've not been able to raise rates to cover increased costs. I'm thinking this bill, HB 2911, is a solution in search of a problem. After reading over the A and Gross version, I believe this bill generates more questions than answers and more hardship for storage unit operators in a difficult economic time. First, in Section 1 on page 1, it talks about a minimum of $100 personal property that can be disposed of at the discretion of the storage facility owner. If you look at the handout that I passed out over there, I gave it to her. Realistically, that once you clean out an average unit full of junk, it usually runs $300 to $650 just for the labor and transportation costs and the dump charges to get rid of stuff. In 19 years, we have had only one unit that was even close to earning what was owed. Most units, when liquidated, rarely generate enough to cover lost rent, much less the cost of inventorying, transporting, cleaning, and auctioning the units. Second, page 1, line 23 is troublesome because it talks about the sale of items at the facility or a suitable place nearby. We typically take our auctionable items to the Woodburn Auction House, some clothing items to Union Gospel Mission, and junk items to the Coffin Butte Landfill in Corvallis. If we hold the sale at our property, we would be allowing access to people without any knowledge as to who they are to be on site, and that can breach the integrity of our security system, which we've pledged to maintain to our other customers. There are many items that the auction house refuses to take, such as used mattresses, couches, clothing, personal papers, etc. We have to recycle or take to the dump or donate to charity. And just a side note about recovering our costs, if we take to the auction, we lose 35% of the value off the top because that's the fee the auction house takes. Used to be 30%, but if you remember that these items are very, very small and they have quite a bit of overhead in auctioning these things, and over the period of years they've found out which items will sell and which ones won't, so they've limited us to bringing only certain items that they feel will sell. If they don't sell at the auction, then they're disposed of by the auction house and then back charged to us for the cost of disposal. Which brings me to my third area. Page 2, line 8, is the part that makes it illegal for an owner or their associates to acquire any of the leftover property. It seems to me that this part infringes on the right to acquire and own property. It is not a matter of wanting to keep something that's left behind, but the fact that the state wants to control my right and the rights of my friends, relatives, associates, and employees to own or purchase property that may be at the auction or may be available in terms of liquidating the unit. The U.S. Constitution under the 14th Amendment says that the state shall not deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. It is not only unconstitutional but unreasonable to prohibit anyone associated with a storage facility from bidding on the contents. In fact, this whole idea of government poking its nose into a private contract between a storage unit operator and tenant is quite disturbing. Yes, it's not right for an owner to take advantage of a tenant, but there's a contract in place when the tenant puts his stuff up, and the tenant puts his stuff up as collateral to guarantee that the rent will be paid, and they understand it will be forfeited if they default on those payments. Ideally, it would be nice to be able to apply the content as we see fit without government interference. Now, under this bill, page 2, line 16, if the lease isn't paid and we have to dispose of the items inside their unit to pay off our costs, any overage we have to keep in some kind of an account for 2 years. This creates an additional bookkeeping headache for us. If we haven't been in contact with the tenant or heirs for 2 years, it's doubtful the state lands will ever hear from them. Finally, is the state going to create some sort of government bureaucracy to examine every unit that is turned over? Will we have to pay the self-storage police? Who is going to enforce all these new laws? Some say HB 2911 closes loopholes in the law. In reality, it creates more government intrusion into the business dealings of the members of an industry. In reality, it makes it more difficult to do business in difficult times. Based on our business experience, the number of times an operator will rip off the tenants with storage liquidation practices are very rare. Also, if an operator is dishonest enough to take advantage of their tenants, they will continue to do so under the revised law. Please do not make changes to the law that will adversely affect our way of doing business.
Thank you for your testimony, and maybe I can get our committee administrator to help me with this, but I believe that several of the things that you mentioned are in the current law, so this bill is not changing the $100 threshold.
We would like to see that increase, the $100 threshold.
And the other one was the holding the property and the two-year requirement. So those are all in the current law.
Those don't bother me so much because in 19 years we've only had one that's even come close to being there but still didn't go over the threshold. But the one that bothers me, I think, the most is the one that dictates the fact that we can't acquire property out of the storage unit ourselves. Or my brother was in the secondhand business, and so if I saw something that he might be able to resell, he can't go to the Woodburn auction on it and bid on it.
Any questions? Senator Churchill.
It would be interesting to get the state treasurer's office in, because I didn't read page 2, lines 8 through 10. I didn't read that new section as being meaning that you couldn't go bid on that at a third-party auction. I'd be interested, because that's a really interesting thing.
Well, the way it's, the verbiage that's there, the way I read it, I couldn't.
I think you may be right. Thank you.
Any other questions? No? Is there anyone else here to testify about House Bill 2911A? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2911A.
After our ethics laws, that could be really interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2911. Now,
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2911A engross to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rosenbaum moves House Bill 2911A engrossed to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No discussion? Ann, will you please call the roll?
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Garage?
No.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
No.
Chair Bonamici?
Aye.
House Bill 2911A goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any volunteers to carry the bill? The chair will carry the bill. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2911A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2371A. And Lori, can you please give us a summary of the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2371A engrossed prohibits with certain exceptions the private entity from swiping an individual's driver license or identification card. It prohibits with certain exceptions storing, sharing, or selling information electronically retrieved from the license or identification card. It limits data that may be electronically retrieved and collected. It allows the use of certain transmitted data to prevent fraud or other criminal activity. It allows a governmental entity to swipe a driver's license or identification card if license or card is knowingly provided, lawfully confiscated, or obtained in certain emergency situations. It provides for certain monetary and equitable relief. It allows an award of a reasonable cost and attorney fees to prevailing plaintiff. There are three amendments before you. The Dash 6s you received earlier this week. The Dash 6s provide an exception for certain actions by a person regulated under the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act, and that allows the swiping of license or identification card pursuant to court rule. The Dash 8s and the Dash 10s are before you at the dais. Those we received this afternoon. The Dash 8s allow commercial radio service provider to swipe individual's license or card with the individual's consent. The Dash 10s reduces the age verification provision to age 18 from age 21, allows for the swiping for credit history with the individual's consent, and allows for the input of personal information into a computerized system for the new account at an individual's request. We had a fiscal statement on the Dash 6s, obviously not on the Dash 8s and the Dash 10s because we just received them. There was no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and conflicts has indicated to us that they are good to go with all of these amendments or each of them.
Thank you, Lori. First, I'm going to call Andrea Meyer, Matt Markey, and Jim Craven, please. Is Betsy Earle's coming as well? We have four chairs at the
Good afternoon, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here on behalf of House Bill 2371, engrossed, a bill that we brought forward. And the purpose of this law is to prevent data harvesting from Oregon driver's licenses and state-issued ID cards. And it establishes restrictions but not an outright ban on private entities and governments from swiping. Now, there are two barcodes on one's Oregon driver's license and ID card. The first barcode has the DMV-issued ID number and date of birth. But the 2D barcode has all the information that is printed on the front of the card with the exception of the photograph. So that's your name, the ID number, date of birth, address, gender, eye color, height, weight, and restrictions such as donor classification or corrective lenses. Some manufacturers use this technology to promote that their scanners can even take photographs or signatures, which are on our card, but generally this is technology that has not been vastly used. And swiping cards, however, is an easy and cost-effective way to collect and use personal information, including information for purposes of unwanted marketing. Driver's licenses should not facilitate the ability to do data harvesting or collection of information about our purchasing, shopping, or lifestyle choices. For example, you go to a bar and they swipe for your age, which we'll talk about is fine, but what we don't want to have happen is after you go to the bar and they swipe to make sure that you're the age, for them to send you an advertisement about their bar or other bars, or to sell your information or share your information, for instance, with an eyeglass vendor because they know you wear eyeglasses from your restrictions on your driver's license. The more the personal information is amassed in more and more databases, it does increase the chance of stolen or misused data. I've added to my testimony information about Choice Point, a data aggregator company. In 2005, they sold thousands of records on Americans' identity that led to theft, and that included name, address, social security number, and led to lots of problems. Now, I want to be clear. We do recognize that mass databases already exist and that genie's not being put back in the bottle, but it's important that we stop the growth and the exposure to identification theft as well as marketing.
we do so prior to the expansion of this technology. Now, the bill as amended, you've heard the definition of swipe. We've made that clear. And the law doesn't limit businesses from taking the information that is currently on your driver's license or identification card in any other way. So, for instance, many businesses collect information on your check from the face of your driver's license, and then they may enter it into a database. This law is silent. It does not restrict that ability to take it in any manner whatsoever other than the swiping. Again, the prohibition on this, there are some prohibitions, but it is not absolute. And but it is intended to eliminate the ability to sort of collect data in one easy format, which is database and easily transferable. And we have worked long and hard with the stakeholders who are sitting here at the table to address their issues in a narrow manner and to preserve the full intent of the proposal and the policy that this has before you. For instance, the original bill had an outright ban on retention of this data whatsoever. It lasted 45 days. You'll see that in working with them in fraud issues, there is no dead date upon which the data has to be destroyed in very limited circumstances. So we've really worked, I think, hard, and I appreciate all the work of everyone here. They'll tell you, I think it took many, many conversations. I want to go over briefly what the bill does. A private entity, and then I do want a moment to address the new issues that have been brought before you today.
And Andrew, if I can ask you to summarize, because with this bill and
all right. Well, the bill is clear in terms of the first two circumstances. You can swipe for identity, authenticize someone and the individual, and you can do that also for age verification of someone under 21, bars, taverns, tobacco. If you do that, that's needed for the moment, and that data cannot be retained. A private entity may swipe to prevent fraud or other criminal activity for returns or refunds of an item when the private entity uses a fraud prevention system, company, or system. And they also may use it for purposes of transmitting information to a check service company. Under the last two, they may retain and store and then share in limited circumstances only four data points: name, ID number, date of birth, and address. That's the testimony. That was what was needed. In turn, another entity, a third-party entity that would receive this information for purposes of fraud prevention, may only use it for that entity to protect. So we don't want redistribution. Now, the Dash 6s will work with Matt Marquis and Jim Marquis, and it's agreed upon section that expands the third-party transfer to if the entity operates under the Federal Fair Credit Reporting Act and only to affect, administer, or enforce a transaction to prevent fraud or other criminal activity if the person provides or receives information and has a contract with the original entity. That's in the Dash 6s. That should be that first paragraph. There's a missing word in there, so we will need to fix that. The next part of the bill you've already heard about, the government. I won't go into that further other than to say the Dash 6s contain amendments that were at the request of Multnomah County Court because of their e-data system that they're using and the ability, in a very limited circumstances. We think the law already provides it, but we're happy as a courtesy to do that. Just to give you, California makes this a crime for violation of swiping law, and Rhode Island has an even more restrictive one. We urge the passage of this bill with the Dash 6s and moving forward before this technology is commonly used. Now, as you will hear from the telecom folks, they have concerns that I met with them today, so I'm able to at least provide a quick response to the concerns. They point to a federal law that restricts the ability of telecom companies from using information. That law had to do with pretexting when someone not authorized called up the telecom and asked for someone's information and used it. So they've got protections in the federal law now. If any of you deal with a wireless, you have to give a certain password when you call to either change or get any information, and those safeguards. That law relates to customer propriety network information, CPNI. That definition is under federal law. It has nothing to do with your personal information that's contained in your driver's license. It has to do with calling record information. And we think that, in general, their concerns and the direction they want to go in their various amendments is contrary to the policy that we're presenting here. To the degree that they do fraud prevention, that's in the law. There is some discussion about consent or opting in, having people opt in, choose to do that under this law. Actually, the Tenth Circuit, under the material provided me today, says that if it's an exclusive opt-in law, that is a violation under the First Amendment. So, and I want to know, and I'm sorry, this is all just a little spot. I'm trying to prepare for what they might be saying, and it's been a little spotty at this point, and so my apologies. But the consent is can be orally or in writing. So when we use the word consent, that's not often kind of the meaningful consent that we are talking about. The law restricts that. I just want to point out, and you'll see at the last attachment of our testimony, despite this law that's federal protection, we in Oregon still do not know, as do we do not know across this country, the release of our telephone calling information to the NSA, we believe against the law. We filed, ACLU of Oregon filed a complaint to the PUC. Verizon refused to even say whether or not it had provided any information to the NSA. One other telecom company said they didn't. As you read reports, Quest said it was a violation of the law. So we are a little alarmed in terms of the this particular business entity and its protection of our information, and would hope that we would not provide and carve out another exception for them. And I will leave it at that, although I'm happy to answer any questions either before
Thank
or after.
You. We'll hear from the whole panel and then take questions, and if we can avoid repeating, it would be
I think
great.
They'll be
Thank
very
you.
Short.
Madam Chairman, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis on behalf of the Consumer Data Industry Association. I just want to say we appreciate the discussions that we've had over this bill over the past several months, and are here to testify in support of the concepts of the A6 amendments and the one change that we would like to see is on line 9, where it reads, if the person receives, we had agreed to put in, if the person provides or receives personal information. That would be the one change that we'd like to see in the amendment. Other than that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Jim?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Craven on behalf of Tech America. First time I've been before your committee all session, so I give the real quick speech. Tech America is the new organization that resulted from the merger of American Electronics Association, AEA, that I've represented for 20 years, and the ITAA. So I do represent Tech America now, but it's basically the client that I have represented in the past. So I'm obliged to give that speech. Senator Burdick's already heard it. Ditto to Mr. Marquis' comments. I have a member company who is in a really interesting niche. This company's sole business proposition is to work with retailers to help prevent fraudulent returns, which I learned in the House committee hearings is a multi-billion dollar, I guess you could call it, industry of people who take things back, usually steal them, and then take them back and get cash back from retailers. It's a huge fraud in America, and I have a member company whose software works with retailers to help prevent that from happening. And some retailers enter information into their database by swiping driver's license cards. So I appreciate our work with ACLU, and we resolved the issues that we had, and that's why you see some of this language about a carve-out for systems to prevent fraud. So that was the angle that I worked on it. We supported the bill in front of the House Consumer Protection group, and I guess I'd say that we, even though it's not my specific issue, that we would also support Mr. Marquis' dash sixes with the little couple extra words. So
thank you very much. Betsy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, can you hear me? Mm-hmm. For the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Retail Council. AOI's Retail Council had many of the same issues that Mr. Craven's member had. In fact, that's one of our members also. Companies using driver's license information to detect fraudulent patterns in return behaviors of their customers. We also have a number of large retailers that use those systems in-house, so we needed to be able to retain the information indefinitely to build strong fraud prevention databases. We worked very well with the ACLU and the other parties up here and are happy to support the bill as it stands right now or with the Dash 6s incorporated.
Thank you very much. Questions for the panel? Senator Girard.
Thank you. I'm looking at three sets of amendments, the Dash 6, the Dash 8, and the Dash 10s. Would you comment on the Dash 8s and the Dash 10s?
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, I just saw those first time an hour ago, so I'm agnostic on the 8s and 10s. I'm not even positive who they're from. So.
Chair Bonamici.
Yes, I think the people who are representing those are here today, and
I think the proponents
will speak for them.
Okay. Chair Bonamici, Senator Ross, briefly, the Dash 8s basically from ACLU's position undermine the bill because they carve out an exception to the whole law for certain private entities, the commercial radio service providers, and as such, we would oppose that because that undermines the policy decision. Fraud is one thing. Providing cutouts for certain entities is not the direction we'd like to see the bill go. The Dash 10s, which I think I've seen the Dash 9s, and they must just be a slight fix, and I believe it comes from a different telecom company, and I believe that to verify an individual's credit history after receiving the individual's consent, my question is why doesn't the Dash 6 for those who are entity under the Federal Fair Reporting Credit Act be covered? And in terms of getting into an individual's request, an individual's consent, that's a landmine for us that begins to undermine and undo this. We don't want businesses saying, hey, if you consent to this, we'll sell you a service, but otherwise we won't.
Andrea, okay. What about the change from 21 to 18 in the Dash 10?
I'll let the proponents speak for themselves, but let me explain the policy that we have, because I think this starts to the age there to the degree that there are any age restriction services, even to get a telephone for someone who's under 18 or under 21 or under 16. We believe the current bill would cover that because for any services that's restricted from under 21, they can swipe the card. So that's bars for drinking age, that's cigarettes, and any other service. We did not include age related to people who are older because the only other age restricted are people who are seniors. And we did not think there was an issue of them marking up their driver's license in some manner so that the face of their license doesn't accurately reflect their age. Because, again, you look at the face of the license, and this is for liquor. Yes, for bars and taverns, I don't know if it's possible, but they might be able to do a little bit of scheming on the license, and that's for them to ensure that someone's the right age.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony, and I'm going to have Richard Kosison come up, please. Oh, and John Powell, you're coming with him?
Yeah, you might do it. Get the city
discount. Thank you for your testimony, and there's a lot of people waiting.
We'll be brief. I understand that, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
While Richard's passing that out, Madam Chair, I'll simply begin. I'm John Powell, representing AT&T. And, Madam Chair, I just want to just very briefly explain what the amendment, the Dash 8 amendments that we propose do and briefly why. If you'll look at the lines 7 and 8 of the Dash 8 amendment, it pretty much explains what we're trying to do, and that is to take the information that we would otherwise manually put into a computer through a swiping mechanism. And this industry has technology in various stages of development to do that. So we're not asking to take information that we wouldn't otherwise be putting into our computers manually. And as you know, in contracting for cell service, it's traditional that you buy a phone, which is a purchase that needs credit information, credit checks, and then you contract for a period of time normally. So we're required to keep that information during the extent of that contract. So we need to store it. And so that is the premise of our amendment, is to allow us to use this technology to do what we would otherwise do manually. And we're talking about millions of contracts, millions of sales that are indeed covered under federal law. And Richard's going to speak to that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard Kosasan with Verizon Wireless. And sorry for the late notice. We could say this is the 11th hour. It's probably closer to the 12th or 13th hour. What I've passed out, two pieces of information, H.R. 4709, enacted in 2006. I would draw your attention to the prohibitions and what constitutes confidential phone record information, and that is found on page 3 of the Act under subsection H, definitions. And it spells out confidential phone record information means information relates to the quantity, technical configuration, type, destination, location, or amount of use of a service offered by a covered entity, subscribed to by any customer of that covered entity and kept by or on behalf of that covered entity solely by virtue of the relationship between the entity and the customer, is made available to a covered entity by a customer solely by virtue of the relationship between the entity and the customer, or is contained in any bill, itemization, or account statement provided to a customer by or on behalf of a covered entity solely by virtue of the relationship. That is the first piece. The second piece relates to FCC regulations, specifically with respect to customer proprietary network information. And that information, basically, as you'll see, is noted as individually identifiable information that is created by a customer's relationship with a communications provider, such as data about the frequency, duration, and timing of calls, the information on the customer's bill, calling identification information. Wireless providers such as Verizon do not sell customer records. They are clearly prohibited from the sale or movement of that information to a third party. There is what I think was referred to earlier as an opt-in provision. The FCC regulations originally started out, there were two options, an opt-in for a customer and an opt-out. The FCC has modified those, so we have only an opt-in situation if indeed the customer chooses to release that information, allowing, quote, the marketing by the individual provider to its customer. So if a customer bought a basic plan and opted in, the provider could go back and suggest that the customer update the equipment, add equipment, etc. So I think in terms of confidentiality and protection, the federal law and the regulations by the FCC clearly take care of that issue. I think...
Mr. Colson, can I ask you to wrap it up because I have to get to the other bill. I have a lot of people waiting.
Madam Chair, I think our problem comes subsection 4 of section 2 of the bill, and it is specifically found in section or lines 16 through 20. Basically, the only way we could swipe the information from a driver's license, store that information, and use that information is for purposes of fraud. If we had some flexibility with that, I think it would be improved. The problem in terms of wireless providers is that we're not centrally located. We provide a nationwide scope and a nationwide footprint. Stores of Verizon that are located in North Carolina. Your child goes to school in North Carolina and you have a family plan. I think it's beneficial for the customer as well as the company to have access and use of that information. So with that, I would very much encourage consideration for this, albeit a very last minute and late delayed presentation to you. I would also encourage perhaps a look at the Tenth Circuit decision that was referenced earlier in terms of free speech. And that was a case out of U.S. West versus the FCC, Tenth Circuit in 1999, I believe.
Thank you. Are there any brief questions?
I have a very brief question.
Senator
Girard. Mr. Powell, who are you representing in this case?
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, AT&T.
AT&T.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2371 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2470A. Lori, can you give us a brief summary, please?
Yeah, I would be happy
very
to.
Very brief.
Okay.
Hear from the witnesses. Thank
All
you.
Right. House Bill 2470A and Gross prohibits the possessing, controlling, or otherwise having charge of more than 50 sexually intact dogs aged 2 years or older for primary purpose of reproduction. It makes a violation of Class B misdemeanor subject to a suspended sentence if the violation is remedied by spaying or neutering. There's a variety of standards of care provisions. There are two amendments that were received today. Dash 11s are before you at the dais. It includes training kennel in list of exceptions to certain provisions, and the dash 12s delete the provision prohibiting the possession controller having charge of more than 50 sexually intact dogs, and it also deletes the provision suspending the misdemeanor charge.
Thank you. And we have Senator Walker and Representative Holvey. Welcome. And right as you're getting started, I want to let everyone know that I plan to split this testimony, a half hour for the proponents of the bill and a half hour for the opponents of the bill. So at 4:30, we will be moving to opponent testimony. So with that, who's on first?
I'm going to defer to the representative.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Bonamici and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify to you today on House Bill 2470A. I'm State Representative Paul Holvey for the record, House District 8, Eugene Lorraine Bonita, and I chair the House Consumer Protection Committee. I'm coming here today to start you out on this bill, to give you a little bit of background on this particular bill and the process we went through. This was a relatively controversial bill, but I had my two vice chairs run work groups on this bill, and quite frankly, we came to an agreement with most people and most breeders on most of the bill. However, having said that, there was a little bit of disagreement on the cap feature in this bill. We heard an extreme amount of testimony from all sorts of folks, law enforcement, animal advocates, dog trainers, dog breeders, and veterinarians, and took all that testimony into consideration to bring the draft that's before you today. There was a significant input, as I said, from the stakeholders, and I believe that the bill before you is in good shape to move as is without amendments. I could certainly answer questions about it, but essentially I'll just roughly tell you that this bill limits the amount of dogs one can possess or control to 50 sexually intact dogs that are over 2 years old. And that is, when you think about it, a lot of dogs. And we found very few. I don't think we found any breeders that came forth that actually had more sexually intact dogs than that in our testimony. We heard from animal regulation authorities who supported this bill, saying this type of bill is needed to help save money for them when they go out and visit these sites that have inhumane standards and inhumane treatment of animals. They have to take them in. It's at great cost to local governments and animal shelters to have to deal with these dogs at that point. This bill provides for minimum care standards. It provides for an exercise period. We did talk about prohibiting the slats in enclosures and the stacking of enclosures. There was exemptions for transportation or temporary facilities in the bill, in subsection 2 of the bill. And we also have a piece in it that helps also address the hoarders, and in the bill there is a limitation or an expectation or a requirement that you have one staff person per 75 dogs in this bill at a particular facility. There's a limit law in this bill as well, and there's also a requirement that retail pet stores provide the consumer with a notice of the location and the breeder of the dog they're buying. That's the bill real briefly, and there's a lot of pieces to it, of course. Specifically, I understand that I have not seen the amendments, but just briefly listening to what they are, I think the one, if I heard right, was an exemption for breeders that are regulated with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. You know, we talked about that, but there was, we had no breeders come forward on the House side under that standard, and I know the state of Washington may have exempted or grandfathered some in, but not for all. But they also have a cap of 50 sexually intact dogs, but only up to 6 months old, which would be, you know, substantially fewer dogs. And I would not be in favor of exempting those federally licensed or regulated shelters. The USDA actually has a blurb on their website about the Animal Welfare Act, and they basically state in this that states have the authority to create and enforce their own regulations, which may exceed those standards. And I think it is their intent that states be able to regulate dog breeders in addition to the standards they have for the large breeders that they regulate. And I don't see this bill in conflict with that. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
We're going to hear from Senator Walker, unless you need to go. Do you need to go?
No,
Senator,
I'm fine.
Senator Walker?
Okay, great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7, and Representative Holvey and I are on the same page here. During the interim, we had learned more about puppy mills and were starting to draft a piece of legislation, and then found out that my colleague from South Eugene was already in process, so we decided to work together on this bill. One of the pieces that I really wanted in the bill and that we did add was the pet store, retail pet store issue, because you go into the mall and you see these pets in the pet store and you have no idea where these dogs came from. I've heard stories about people buying those dogs and they don't make it and they have diseases and whatnot. And so I really wanted a little bit more consumer protection when someone buys a dog from a pet store. I've never done that myself, but some people do, and that's why they stay in business. But House Bill 2470 is really trying to crack down on puppy mills. We do have puppy mills in the state of Oregon. Just recently in March, there was a raid and a bust of a puppy mill in Burns, Oregon, where 150 dogs were rescued that were mangy, diseased, and is basically suffering from being in that kind of a situation. We've had another puppy mill arrest, and, you know, I had someone ask me on the House side, well, has your sheriff busted any puppy mills? And I said, well, not that I know of, but my sheriff is underfunded at the moment because my county commissioners refused to cough up some of the Secure Rural Schools funds, and so my sheriff is currently underfunded. But be that as it may, what we're trying to get at are the large-scale commercial dog breeding operations that mass-produce puppies, and by and large, the people that you will hear from today who are opposed to this bill are excellent breeders. We're trying to get at the people who don't live in the sunlight. They live in the shadows. The unwitting consumer buys one of these dogs, and they become quite disappointed when they find out where this dog has come from. I will tell you that originally the bill was at capped it at 25 dogs. I wish we could have kept it there. But in the building, you have to make compromises, and that was one of our compromises. Oregon has no statewide laws to regulate puppy mills or limit them, so we believe that the 50-dog limit is appropriate. And the reason I want to say that is let me just give you this information. The average female breeding dog can have at least 2 litters every year. In many puppy mills, it's actually common for them to have more than that. So assuming 18 of the dogs are females, with an average litter size of just under 5 puppies, breeders will be able to sell as many as 180 puppies a year. Well, if you double that and give them 36 dogs, you're going to have 360 puppies a year, which is pretty much a dog a day. That's plenty of puppies in my view. There has been some conversation about having the AKC. If they're AKC registered, they should be exempt from the bill. But I will tell you that my dog could be AKC registered if I so chose to do that, but I didn't do that. He's a purebred. It's a voluntary registry, and the breeder can register the dog with them or not, and there is no guarantee if they're AKC registered or USDA registered that they are not a puppy mill. An AKC has an inspection program for breeders who register seven or more litters per year, but they have no rules to disallow puppy mills, and whatever inspection they do is not public. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's been a lot of work put into this bill, and I want to commend Representative Holvey and his committee because we followed this bill very closely. We testified, we watched it on television, and there was a lot of anxiety about this bill and multiple amendments that they had to choose from. I believe this is a fair compromise, and we have done our work as best that we can, and I'm quite pleased with the result. So.
Thank you very much, Senator. And I'm going to ask, unless you have some very pressing questions, there's a lot of people who want to testify, so if there's something you really need to ask, go ahead.
I got some questions I need to ask. The Dash 11 amendments actually exempt out training facilities. And now you do understand there's a difference between breeders and trainers. These are people that teach a discipline, and especially in the hunting arena, bird dogs. Do you have a problem with exempting out training facilities from the 50-dog maximum? Because it's easy for them to go over 50 dogs, especially a month or two before duck hunting or pheasant hunting starts.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, and we did discuss trainers, and as such in the bill, trainers would either be fall under the boarding kennel exemption if in fact they the stay at the facility an average of less than 30 days, and so they if that's the case, their trainer keeps a dog less has 50 dogs less than 30 days, they would be exempt from that provision under that provision. So we asked legislative council about that, and that was their take on that, because we did talk to them about that. And if they have more dogs than that, more than 30 days, it was felt that these provisions should apply to them.
And Madam Chair and Senator Girard, I would also say that Section 1, Sub 2, says a person may not possess, control, or otherwise have charge of at the same time, more than 50 sexually intact dogs that are 2 years of age or older for the primary purpose. The primary purpose of reproduction. A training facility's primary purpose is not reproduction, Senator, as you know. It is training.
Well, we just want to clarify that, so we have a Dash 11 to make sure that trainers are not included in this bill. So would you be opposed to that, Senator? Or
Madam Chair and Senator Girard, I don't think it's necessary. So, yes. I think the bill covers that exemption right now.
Okay, and the second question I have is, we're looking at a penalty of 6 months imprisonment and $2,500 fine or both. And there's a lot of people feel that there's too many people put in prison right now, and this would make it more of a penalty than someone that breaks into my home, steals everything, and for property crimes. And I'm trying to understand the rationale for such an extreme penalty.
Do you want to answer that, Senator, or Representative?
No, this provision was talked about a little bit. There wasn't a lot of disagreement from the stakeholders on that provision in the bill. It was something that most of the stakeholders agreed to. Was not anything that was discussed, and that is a maximum penalty for the most egregious cases.
Final question.
Go ahead.
On page 3, line 4, you mandate a solid floor. It is my understanding that a lot of the newer facilities actually have a really solid, but it's a fine mesh floor, so like the urine goes out and they collect the urine and reprocess it. Why are we putting in statute something such as that, so that we're actually going against the trend towards a better facility.
That definition was also discussed with all the stakeholders, and the solid floor without slats or gaps was what they decided that they all agreed that that's was what was fine in the bill. I heard no distinction about that. It's mostly the flats or the slats and the gaps were the concern, and that's what the bill speaks to, is a floor without slats or gaps. So I think what you're describing is probably fits within the bill, as long as it doesn't have slats or gaps in it.
Senator Rosenbaum, you have a quick question?
Yes, really quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for all your work on this. I had a question about the exercise provision in there, which costs for an hour a day. Does that mean that for the other 23 hours a day, these dogs can be kept in enclosures that meet the other specifications?
Yes, that does.
And just a quick follow-up, that when I've looked at puppies, a lot of times the puppies are in sort of a enclosure like a pen or something, either with or without the mother. So does those puppies, I would assume, that would satisfy what you're not saying these puppies have to be taken out at a really young age to be exercised, are you?
No, they have to be let out of their enclosure into an open area where they can exercise. I believe, in the bill as well. It doesn't reflect that you have to go out there and run with the dog. The dog's just got to be able to get out and get exercise.
Thank you. And I'm going to have the next panel come up. And here's what I'm going to do. The next panel, thank you very much for
your
testimony.
Welcome.
The next panel is Scott Beckstead, Sharon Harmon, and Judy Brandt. And following them will be Carrie Tyler, Carrie Mullen, Ted Paul, and Jamie Fitzpatrick. So you can be sort of on deck. And then if you have a written testimony especially, please just summarize it because we want to get as many people as we can to testify. So please just summarize your written testimony and we'll get as many people as we can to come up. Thank you. Please go ahead and start.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is Scott Beckstead. I'm the Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States on behalf of our roughly 145,000 members throughout the state of Oregon. I'm here to offer our support in favor of House Bill 2470. I was part of the initial working group that worked on this bill, along with an assortment of veterinarians, breeders, and other interested stakeholders. The bill before you reflects, we believe, the best hope for providing dogs in large breeding operations with a basic standard of care. I'm going to make this really brief in light of the testimony that is going to be offered, but essentially, if you pass a bill without a cap, there will be puppy mills in Oregon. If you pass a bill that exempts AKC-approved, certified, or inspected facilities, there will be puppy mills in Oregon. If you exempt breeders who possess a USDA license, there will be puppy mills in Oregon. The point is, to pass a bill that promotes responsible breeding, the people that will testify in opposition to this bill have nothing to fear from this bill. The people who are targeted by this bill are staying as far away from this process as they possibly can. Washington has just passed a puppy mill statute that sets a 50 breeding dog limit. The state director for Washington for the Humane Society of the United States is here to answer any questions, should there be any, about the effect of the Washington legislation. But one of the effects is going to be that there will be puppy mill operators in Washington that will be looking for new states to set up shop in. They will be following very closely what passes in the state of Oregon. So I urge you to take a stand for the benefit of our faithful companions. Pass the bill without any amendments and guarantee that these animals receive the basic level of care that they need and deserve. Thank you, and I'm open for any questions.
And can you give us the name, please, of the person from Washington so we can make sure that we can call her if we need to?
Yes, Jennifer Fearing.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Jennifer Hillman.
Thank you.
Sorry, Jennifer.
Okay. Next, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judith Brand, and I am a deputy district attorney and have been a prosecutor with the state of Oregon for 26 years. I have personally been involved in the investigation, prosecution, and conviction of a puppy mill. I'm not going to go through with you the horrors of the puppy mills that we have seen here in the state of Oregon. I will just say that in my one particular case, 161 animals were rescued from a woman who was a retired nurse, had been breeding puppies, and was a high regarded breeder in the community for 30 years. Was AKC approved and inspected regularly and passed, and yet she had 161 animals living in urine, feces, and rat-infested filth. The house was condemned. The Gaston Police Department or Fire Department would not use it for burning training because it would put noxious fumes into the air. And this woman was a nurse, was AKC registered, was a known breeder. I was in the puppy mill work group, and a breeder told me that she knew of a puppy mill, and when I asked her had she reported it to the authorities, she said no because of political concerns. The breeders are not policing their own, so we need to police them. The penalty is only a Class B misdemeanor. Burglars go to prison for a minimum of 18 months or more in the state of Oregon. This puppy mill, it says that the most they will get is 6 months or $2,500. That's the cap of it. The woman that, in my case, abused 161 puppies got probation, 240 hours of community service, and a $10,000 fine. She did not do a day in jail. So it's going to be uncommon for them to go to jail. We need the cap desperately because there are not enough animal control officers in the state of Oregon. Most of the people responding to animal abuse are regular police officers. In my very own case, a deputy sheriff went out 8 months earlier, saw that the woman had 80 dogs, thought things didn't look good, but didn't know what to do, and we have animal control officers. He sent them a memo and nothing happened. 8 months later, we are rescuing 161 dogs who are still so socially deprived that their owners are having constant problems with them. We've adopted them all. Five were so feral they could not be adopted. We have adopted them all out. There absolutely has to be a cap. There were 80 dogs, and that deputy sheriff had that cap. He would have said, oh, there's more than 50 dogs.
Judy, I'm going to have you wrap up because I need to get to Sharon and
the cap
one
is
more
absolutely
panel.
Essential.
Thank
for
you.
Law
Sharon,
enforcement.
You go ahead, please.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, my name is Sharon Harmon. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Humane Society, an independent animal welfare organization in Oregon, not connected to the Humane Society of the United States. We're here in support of House Bill 2470. We were part of the work group. We had long discussions about the elements of this bill, and we're looking today at Dash 11 and Dash 12 amendments that are really repeats of amendments that were considered in the House and decided against. What you have is a good compromise. But I got to tell you, this bill does not go far enough to put into law that it's acceptable for dogs to stand up, lay down, and turn around in an enclosure for 23 hours a day. How could that be the right thing for man's best friend, woman's best friend, too, I might add? It doesn't go far enough. But like all things in life, it's a compromise. I don't think that this bill should be amended. We need a cap. To have 50 dogs more than age of two and up to age of two, as many as you like, Do you know what the enforcement potential is of that? Ted Tellison had over 200 dogs in his property. We took 125. First week cost was $61,000. That's provided free of the state by the donors of the Oregon Humane Society, but it is a crushing financial blow to deal with a large-scale puppy mill. This bill is a reasonable compromise, and we hope you support it. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm going to have the next panel come up. Carrie Tyler, Carrie Mullen, Ted Paul, and Jamie Fitzpatrick, and we have 5 minutes for this panel, and then we need to move to the opposition. And if there's anybody here who's come from more than 100 miles, did you check on the list? Okay. Okay, please go ahead, especially if you have written testimony. Please just summarize it. Go ahead, please. Thank you.
Okay. My name is Ted Paul. I'm a resident of South Salem. I've been a small business owner in the state of Oregon for 28 years. My credentials are important because of the testimony involved. I'm a past president of the Collie Club of America. At the time I was president, it was the largest single-breed club in the world. I am one of the original founders of the American Dog Owners Association. I am the past president of Purebred Dog Breeders and Fanciers Association. And as you legislators know, I'm an active supporter board member of the very successful Project Pooch program at McLaren Youth Correctional Facility in Woodburn, Oregon. I have been an AKC licensed dog judge for the past 33 years. I have judged dogs from coast to coast in this country, also South America and Canada. And I have judged the Collie Club of America National Specialty Show 3 times, including their prestigious 100th anniversary show. I have raised and shown many show champions, one of which went on to win the breed at Westminster Kennel Club, owner-handled, which is a real chore. And I've been the featured speaker at symposiums and banquets well over 75 times.
Mr. Paul, I'm going to do what we do in law, and we're going to agree that you're an expert. And so if you could tell us what your testimony is, because I'm sorry.
Could you put that in writing, please?
Because I want to make sure that we get the equal time here. So if you could summarize your position on the bill, it would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I realize we're running late. In the role of the hobby breeder, I come forward today to urge you, our state legislators, to push forward and pass House Bill 2470 into law. Give our state this much-needed tool to crack down on Oregon puppy mills, these unscrupulous individuals who give all breeders, as well as the sport of purebred dogs, a bad name. It should be the desire of all breeders in this state to strongly support HB 2470 as it directly addresses the cruel and inhumane treatment of man's best friend and woman's best friend at the most vulnerable stage in their life, birth.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on to the next person, and Lori's going to start timing because we need to move to the next panel. So please summarize.
I'm an animal services deputy in Lincoln County. Work for
the
sheriff's
office.
Your name
for the record, please?
Carrie Tyler.
Carrie.
I've been in the animal control and protection field for the better part of the last 20 years. And as some of the speakers before illustrated quite well, the expense of caring for the animals involved in busts of these kind are massive. Most of the shelters in Oregon are very much smaller than Oregon Humane Society. In fact, there's only one that's close to that size. My shelter is that small, too, and is actually facing budget cuts and may close. So I see from that standpoint the financial burden on a county or jurisdiction of these kind of busts, and I strongly support the bill. I also see the animals that come into the shelter from these type of facilities after they've been rejected by their owners who try and try but can't fix their health or mental problems. Another reason why I strongly support the bill. And I also do not support the current amendments that are today. Thank you.
We have Carrie and Jamie, please.
Go ahead. I'm Jamie Fitzpatrick. I'm Shelter Operations Director for Willamette Humane Society here in Salem. I started in animal welfare about 7 years ago when I was with Heartland Humane Society. During my time there, about 2 years ago, I was involved in the case in North Albany where 86 dogs were seized from a home there. I think those were the pictures that were being passed around. The there's been argument that cases such as these are hoarders as opposed to breeders, but you have to remember, first and foremost, this woman was breeding dogs for sale. She was advertising them on the internet, meeting people at rest stops to sell these puppies who had been raised in horrible conditions. They weren't cared for. The dogs and the puppies weren't cared for humanely. They were found in horrible conditions, dirty, matted, parasite-infested, not well socialized. While even 2 years afterwards, folks are still dealing with those socialization issues. We received comments from people who had purchased these puppies over the internet who had problems with them health-wise and behavior-wise after the fact and were not able to reach her, so they had no recourse. A bill like this would help in that case. Yes, the other argument is that this case did get addressed through the current law, but it literally took years when literally hundreds of dogs and puppies were in this woman's care not being treated appropriately or humanely, and it's not fair for law enforcement only to be able to step in when it becomes that horrific and that long-term. We have to stop
it. I need
to
ask you to wrap up. And if you could summarize, and then while you're getting ready, there's a panel of appear to be veterinarians. If you could pick one to sort of be a spokesperson to come up quickly, from Dr. Larry Peets, Jeanette Kessler, Dr. Luis Castanelli. Are you all veterinarians? Is there one who you can be a spokesperson to come up quickly for the veterinarian? Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Carrie Mullen. I have been in the field of animal welfare for most of the last 15 years. I was the executive director at Heartland Humane Society in Corvallis at the time of the case that the photos were passing around. I just think it's important to think about those photos and what they illustrate, because while she was definitely a puppy mill and the internet does change the world of dog breeding, those dogs were not caged, which is fortunate for those dogs. But when we talk about the cage requirements and some of the other great standards we do have in the bill we're proposing today, they wouldn't have touched her. Only the cap would have come into play for her and the veterinary consumer protection requirements. The cap is an important part of this bill.
Thank you so much. So there's a Connie Thiel or Teal who came from more than 100 miles. If you could come up. And then either Dr. Larry Peets or Dr. Kessler or Dr. Castanelli, please come up. One of you, please, quickly. Thank you. Okay, can you state your name for the record, please? And then after this panel, I'm going to go to the opponents. So go ahead.
Chair, Senators, thank you for the honor of being able to be here today and talk to you. I am just here as a citizen, and my experience is very personal. About back in 1996, I adopted two dogs that came from a very notorious puppy mill up in Newport, Oregon. This is Carson and Laura. Carson is now passed on, but they came from a horrible puppy mill where they were chained in the snow in barrels, and there was literally dead dog parts all around, and they had to walk among dead dog parts. No food, no water. And I adopted them. I was a fool, what can I say, but I took them on. I have never seen such damaged dogs in my entire life, and I've rescued dogs for years. They were literally catatonic. I had to take 20-foot-long ropes and take them out in the backyard and pull them in by the rope to get them to come in, and they were just completely afraid pretty much their whole lives. I still have Laura. She's doing well, but they've suffered a lot in their lives. And Carson got Addison's disease, which is a disease that some people think is caused by stress. And so the physical and mental suffering these dogs have gone through, personally, I really think this bill should go through. And I do it. Thank you for all the work that Senator Walker and Hope, Representative Hobie, that you've worked on this. And thank you.
Thank you.
Please pass this bill.
I'm Dr. Larry Peets, veterinarian in private practice here in Oregon, have been for the last 39 years. I'm here in support of House Bill 2470 and would encourage you to pass it with as presented. No amendments, no exceptions. We need the cap. Mm-hmm. The standard of care for these in these puppy mills goes down as the number of animals go up. Mm-hmm. And as a veterinarian, we see the end result of this indiscriminate breeding in the animals that are presented to us that have been purchased, generally impulse buying. People see something that's really cute, they grab it, take it home. By the time it makes it to our clinic, they've already become attached to it, and it's not like a toaster that you can just take back if it's defective. But we see these little critters with genetic defects because of indiscriminate and improper breeding, and it's not only a burden on the people But if you think about the animals and think about the inhumanity of it, it becomes a very obvious thing. We need a bill like this in Oregon. We need it passed with a cap and no exceptions. So I would encourage
Thank you for your testimony on behalf of the veterinarians. I appreciate that. And next I'm going to go to the opponents. And first I'm going to take the people who have come from a distance, Carol Lackey, Noreen Cartwright, Kathy Ettinger, and Lawrence Schwartz, please. And it would be helpful if you, when you listen to each other's testimony, if you try not to repeat what others have said and summarize your testimony, especially if you have written testimony, because we will read your written testimony. Welcome, and you can go ahead and start as soon as you're seated, and then the other two can join you. Are the other?
Sorry.
There should be four people here I call.
Chairman Bonamici and members of the committee, my name is Lawrence Schwartz, and I'm from Seal Rock on the Oregon coast. I am also an expert in this area, and my credentials are summarized in my written testimony, so I won't go through them. I will mention, however, that I am also a founding member of the American Dog Owners Association, longtime secretary of that association, and that association is very much opposed to this bill. House Bill 2470 is actually two different intentions bundled into one bill. One of these is a lemon law, the real cup of tea of this committee. The other deals with dog abuse in an attempt to alleviate the proliferation of substandard breeding operations in the state of Oregon, and perhaps should really be before another more appropriate committee. I'm not opposed to the concept of this bill, but the mechanisms of the bill leave much to be desired. I have distributed to the committee OAR 603-015-0025, care of pet and captive animals. This is the most comprehensive statute and covers the dog abuse side of what HB 2470 tries to do. It covers animal pounds, boarding kennels, commercial kennels, grooming parlors and pet shops, much more of the dog industry than does HB 2470. It does everything that HB 2470 attempts to do and does it better without resorting to the unnecessary concept of numerical limits. This is existing Oregon law. We do not need new law. Only a very few amendments to this very good present law. We do not need new law here, as we have one of the strongest animal abuse laws in the nation, to the credit of the Oregon legislature. Instead of new legislation, we need only to have the will to enforce the law we now have on the books and not try to create new laws to reinvent the wheel. HB 2470, at best, weakens current law. The dog abuse side of HB 2470 may have many unintended consequences. There is no mechanism for measurement of the number of dogs in the proposed act. The only way to count dogs would be for a law enforcement officer to gain access to the premises. HB 2470 avoids due process by establishing probable cause through the use of numbers. A law enforcement officer could enter any premises at any time of day or night without a warrant, ostensibly to count dogs. This sets up any property owner for harassment, whether or not they have dogs. HB 2470 is a setup for harassment. Feuds between neighbors could be exacerbated by simply making a dog complaint to animal control that there were the trigger numbers of dogs on the premises, a complaint which they would be required to act upon. The trigger mechanism for an animal control law should be behavior, not numbers. An analogy here would be to use, for gun control, the concept of 50 guns as a trigger mechanism, and over 50 would be controlled. The other side of HB 270 has to do with the lemon aspects of the law, to protect the buyer of the dog, which is not adequately covered in present Oregon law. The lemon law features provide protections for the purchaser of a dog, but do not provide provisional protections for the seller. For example, a veterinarian exam should occur within 48 hours of purchase, not 15 days, as House Bill 2470 requires. 15 days is longer than the incubation period for many common canine infectious diseases. There is one feature that is flawed and would have to be changed before this part of the bill is considered for enactment. Section 5B states that a customer is entitled to remedy if within 2 years after the customer acquires the dog, a veterinarian states in writing that the dog has or the dog died as a result of a congenital or hereditary defect adversely affecting the health of the dog or requiring hospitalization or non-elective surgical procedures. The problems with this clause are twofold. First, there are only a few conditions assumed hereditary for which we have reliable DNA tests. Multi-genetic conditions such as epilepsy, hip dysplasia, heart disease, and cancer do not have such tests, and their eventual occurrence cannot be established a priori before a puppy is sold. All known DNA tests appropriate for a breed should be performed before a sale with the results shared with the purchaser. There should be no recourse for a purchaser for diseases which cannot be detected a priori. Thank you for the opportunity to testify for your committee. I'd be happy to volunteer for any work groups you might plan for the future of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz. Next, please.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Noreen Cartwright. I went to my first dog show in 1962. I've been judging dog shows since 1968. Interestingly enough, I was one of the first members of the American Dog Owner Association. I, too, have judged my national specialty. I am opposed to this bill. There's several problems that run with it. HB 2470 is a feel-good bill. It sounds like we're passing something wonderful, that by passing this bill, somehow people are going to get healthy, well-bred, well-cared-for puppies, that this is the only way that they're going to get those. Well, I wish passing a bill was that simple, because then we would have no rapes, no murders, no frauds, no lies, no burglaries. The key to this bill is what is not in its provisions. And why am I as a hobbyist opposed? Because this bill affects me, and the number that affects me is 10. Not 25, not 50, not 75, it's 10, because at 10 or more, I fall under the requirements for the housing. I fall under with breeding or selling 3 or 4 litters a year under the provisions of being a pet dealer. It affects the small Oregon hobbyists who've been involved in pet welfare, dog bills, dog shows, for years and years and years. There is also a great deal of confusion around the puppy mill. Puppy mill is an outdated pejorative term that is 30, 40, 50 years old. Let's separate the fact that there are large-scale commercial breeders who are federally regulated, licensed, and inspected from the persons who are always going to be under the radar, that no law is going to affect, from the persons who are hobbyists, from the persons who are trainers. You're not dealing with one common path thing. Let's also twist into this mix the fact that every time there is something with a large number of dogs, especially if it's adverse, the yell is puppy mill. Remember, it's a pejorative, outdated term. Every instance that has been cited by the supporters of this bill has also been prosecuted under current Oregon and or federal law. And I'd like to mention specifically this poor guy in Burns in Harney County. The first story was that he voluntarily turned in about 200 dogs because of his age and his inability to take care of them. Gradually, that story has turned into, by damn, he was a puppy miller. Well, you know what the guy was doing in Harney County, among other things? Harney County doesn't have an animal shelter. This guy was taking in the Harney County strays and caring for them until he was too old to be able to care for his dogs. He voluntarily turned them in. And now people are yelling and hollering that he was a puppy miller. This is the kind of thing that gets mixed up when somebody doesn't do the research. And I would strongly suggest to the committee, instead of taking my word or anybody else's words about status of the laws, that you do your own research on what the Oregon already anti-cruelty inexistent laws say and what is on the books for the federal USDA regulations of the commercial breeders. Separate that out from the people who are buying dogs from others who are never going to comply with any kind of a law. What are the justifications for this bill? That's the key of this thing. Read the four whereases in the brand new bill. It's a brand new bill, ladies and gentlemen, because there are two lines left in this bill from the House version. Two lines. The small breeders, the hobbyist breeders, our part of being a stakeholder was not recognized in those committee negotiations. There were certain issues that were non-negotiable. It was take it or leave it. We took what we could get, and now we're talking to you. We do not want the numbers on there. We do need the conditions. The numbers are confusing in the first place. I tried to track numbers, and I'll get back to that in a minute. The first whereas says, whereas large commercial breeders may result in cruelty. Well, that means they may not.
it may lead to the sale of unhealthy dogs. Guess what? It may not. It often inflicts conditions of long-term suffering. Where are the numbers? How often does that specific condition inflict conditions of suffering? And is it only if you've got an X number of dogs? What happens to people that have one dog at their house and you see the poor dog chained out in the backyard in the snow? It's not directly always connected to commercial breeders. Then the last thing it says, that large-scale commercial breeding contributes to overpopulation. Sorry about that, guys. How? It's a distribution problem. Did you know that the Centers for Disease Control says that there are over 300,000 dogs a year imported into the United States to fill empty animal shelter runs scattered across this country? The Border Patrol estimates that there are 10,000 dogs a year coming in across the border of Mexico. One instance, one border, 10,000 a year.
Ms. Cartwright, I'm going to have to ask you to wrap it up because there's a lot of other people who want to testify.
All right, one last thing. In several places, it refers to intact dogs over 8 months of age in this bill. The implication is that if you spay or neuter your dogs before 8 months of age, you're not going to be affected by this bill. You won't have to abide by the conditions. There's been veterinary research done, and quickly, spaying of bitches before 1 year of age significantly increases the risk of osteosarcoma. It increases the risk of splenic hemangiosarcoma and cardiac hemangiosarcoma by a factor of 5. It triples the risk of hypothyroidism. It increases the risk of obesity by a factor of 1.6 to 2. It causes urinary spay incontinence. It increases the risk of persistent or recurring urinary tract infection. It increases the risk of a resulcent vulva, vaginal dermatitis, vaginitis. It doubles the risk of urinary tract tumors. It increases the risk of orthopedic disorders, and it increases the risk of adverse reactions to vaccinations. Plus, there is an increased risk of aggression, food, animal, and human aggression, simply by removing those hormones way too early. And this is part of what will happen in this bill. Thank you very much. I'd be delighted to answer questions or to participate on any further work groups.
Thank you for your testimony. And next, please.
I'll make this really fast. My name is Kathy Ettinger. I'm from Medford, Oregon, and I'm just going to hit on a few things. I am opposed to 2470, although this bill seems like a solution, it's a problem. I'm a small hobby breeder. It's not supposed to affect me. It's going to affect me drastically. The cap numbers, everybody keeps talking about the cap numbers. I'm going to be very explicit about this. My mother happened to raise dogs when I was a child. She was a commercial breeder. She had well over 50 dogs. We did show dogs also. Let me tell you, it was done very well. It's hard work. It means getting up early in the morning and working all day long. It's not an easy job. It's not for you've got to be dedicated. A lot of times when you finish at the end of the day, working all day, you'll stay up late whelping a litter of puppies or supplementing a weak puppy. Not because you want that money from the sale of the puppy. It's because you care about those animals. You don't want to go into breeding dogs if you don't care about the animals. Another thing that really concerns me is the funding issues with this bill. County governments do not have the money to hire the personnel it's going to take to have inspections. If there's no money to hire the inspectors, who's going to say who's wrong? A lot of these kennels that are a problem right now happen to fall under this HB 2470 are going to go underground if this bill becomes a law. And authorities will not be able to find them. Already it's hard to find breeders who sell dogs over the internet or travel over the state lines to sell puppies. These types of dog breeders do exist, and there will be many more like them if this bill becomes a law. And I'm going to cut it short because someone to my right here has something very important to say.
Thank you. And you're Ms. Lackey?
Okay, my name is Carol Lackey. I am a commercial dog breeder. I oppose HB 2470. I've been a commercial kennel operator for the last 50 years. My mother was also a commercial kennel operator who was a founding member of the Southern Oregon Kennel Club. I am good at what I do, and I provide excellent care for my dogs I keep. The puppies I produce are healthy, well-socialized, and loved by the people who purchase them. I am an honorary member of the Southern Oregon Kennel Club, a charter member of the Rogue Valley Kennel Club. I have been, in the past, a board member of the Southern Oregon Humane Society and a past member of the Jackson County Animal Advisory Board. I have produced many top-winning champions, Yorkshire Terriers, Maltese, Chihuahuas, Miniature Schnauzers, Pomeranian. These were not only beautiful representatives of the breed, but they were very healthy. I have worked consciously throughout my dog breeding career to constantly improve my standards of care, to upgrade my kennel, and take advantage of new knowledge and veterinary advantages as they come along. My kennel business employs several local citizens to help me with cleaning, grooming, and socializing my dogs, and it supports local businesses by purchasing thousands of dollars of goods and veterinary services annually. I am currently regulated by the Federal Animal Welfare Act, Jackson County Animal Control, and the American Kennel Club, and I am regularly inspected by all three. My kennel is also inspected by a veterinarian once a year at my expense. Surely breeders like me who are already heavily regulated and doing it right should be exempt from this bill. This bill has been presented to you by people who regard all commercial dog breeding kennels as puppy mills. So you may be surprised to learn that I view my dog breeding business as honorable, professional, and beneficial to the dogs I raised and to society. Please recognize that you have been hearing about commercial kennels almost exclusively from sources that are not objective about the subject, people whose fundraising abilities or ratings depend on stereotyping people like me. I just ask that before you vote on this bill, you will question the objectives of the materials that form your opinion about all large-scale breeders. There is no question that commercial dog breeding, just like other occupations, includes substandard operators. But is it right to punish someone who does it right because others do not? Basically, I'm asking you not to vote with prejudice. Regulating dog breeders by the number rather than by the care they provide and the quality of puppies they produce is simply wrong.
Ms. Lackey, I need to ask you to wrap up your testimony. I want to get one more panel,
okay,
and there's another committee coming into the room.
Okay. I oppose the HB 24, and if you are going to pass it, I'd like to have the USDA kennels be exempt.
If we can get, thank you for your testimony. And while I'm calling the next panel, will you just please let us know, Ms. Lackey, how many sexually intact dogs do you have that are 2 years old or 2 years of age or older?
I have over 50.
Thank you. Suzanne Lemire, Mark Cushing, and Jeff Jennings, please. And we have about 6 minutes because the next committee is waiting.
Can I go ahead and get started then?
Please do.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Madam Chair.
Start talking while you're walking.
My name is Mark Cushing. I'm a partner in Tonkin Torp, a law firm in Portland. I have the privilege, even though I'm based in Portland, of having a national practice focusing on animal welfare, pets, and veterinary care. I represent Banfield Pet Hospital, the world's largest veterinary hospital group in 45 states and in the federal government. I am not here today on behalf of Banfield. I'm here on behalf of the National Animal Interest Alliance, which is a Portland-based animal welfare group. The last witness, Mrs. Lackey, is the perfect example of what's wrong with this bill. And understanding the politics of this legislature, I want to focus on an amendment that is perfectly appropriate, is fair, absolutely protects the state if it needs protecting, and it has been demeaned in sort of a superficial fashion by witnesses beforehand. Let me address it substantively, please. I've had the privilege in my practice of working directly with the USDA and the director of the Animal Welfare section of the USDA extensively. I'm very familiar with the Animal Welfare Act, passed in 1970, amended three times since. It is a comprehensive statute that has explicit standards which have been taken by the agency in the Code of Federal Regulation and made a very extensive regulatory scheme, and no offense to this legislature, but the standard of care, housing, sanitation, exercise, everything you want to talk about that's in this bill is in the AWA. It is a comprehensive statute. And if you breed dogs and you sell them to pet stores, and if you breed dogs in America and you sell them to brokers, it unfortunately does not cover the breeding of dogs and selling them directly to the public. And that's a separate issue. But NAIA, our group, which would support that, wants you to consider a very simple amendment. And we have a representative from the state of Washington, and what wasn't mentioned in the summary of Washington's passage of a 50-dog cap and signed by Governor Gregoire, I believe, just a week ago, was that they amended and have an exemption for commercial dog breeders that are licensed by the USDA. And that's an explicit exemption in the Washington statute, and it makes sense. So let me tell you why.
Mr. Cushing, I'm sorry, but there's another committee coming in.
Can I give you 30 seconds? The USDA,
quickly,
I understand, Madam Chair. The USDA inspects before your license. If you don't meet their inspection criteria, you're not licensed. They inspect throughout your tenure. And there are literally approximately 15 dealers in Oregon, or 15 breeders in Oregon, that are subject to that licensing and that are licensed. And there will be no harm done to the state, and breeders like Mrs. Lackey appropriately should be exempted because they meet that standard of care currently. And there's no evidence that current Oregon dealers licensed by the USDA are not honoring their strict standards of care, which at least match this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cushing, and I'm sorry, but just a couple minutes apiece. Sorry.
I'm Suzanne Lemire, and my family has about 125 years of combined dog breeding experience. I passed out the blue folder to you because this bill is unfortunately taking us back to the dinosaur age as far as kennel floors and kennel deckings that's available. As you mentioned, Senator Girard, the kennel deck and kennel floors, the newest ones that are out there, antibacterial, anti-mildew, anti-fungicide, you name it, are illegal with this law, and that really needs to be changed. The other thing, Senator Rosenbaum, I heard in your voice, love and care for those puppies. When you have puppies, when they're born, the mama has to make them go potty by licking them, okay? They eat that waste for up to 6 weeks. Depending upon how many puppies she has in the litter, depends upon how much waste that is. The dogs can only handle so much. So at some point, usually at 2 weeks, in order to keep the puppies from being in their own urine and their own waste, you really need to put them on a small raised platform up off of the ground. And it can be a grid that is very fine so that they don't get themselves caught in it in any way, but it does protect them and keep them disease free. It also keeps the mom from eating too much of the waste and becoming protozoa filled and bacteria filled herself. So that's a couple of things you really have to consider with this bill. I'd very much like to see that part removed. The other thing, the double deck section could also be looked at because we as breeders try to copy the vets because they set good examples for us. And for puppies, a double decker section with a solid divider in between is absolutely appropriate. It gives us good care, good access to those puppies. Thank you much.
Thank you. Mr. Jennings?
My name is Jeff Jennings. I'm going to speak specifically to, first of all, I own a kennel that is licensed in Clackamas County. I went through a two-year period to get land use approval for that. The kennel is, although I am a breeder on a small scale, the kennel is primarily a training kennel. And so I would like to speak on behalf of training kennels, and not only for myself, but there are a number of these professional facilities throughout Oregon that will be affected by this bill. We heard testimony earlier that to the effect that sufficient exceptions have been made in the current form of the bill that you see that would not affect me. I don't know where the idea came from that a dog can be trained in 30 days but I'd like to correct that notion that it can take up to 3 years.
Longer than it's my dog.
Absolutely. I have produced puppies that later became service dogs, including search and rescue. I have a dog. In fact, I am a vendor for the Oregon Department of Human Services. I have placed dogs for seizure response that took several years to train. Excuse me. I trained for sportsmen, for hunting dogs, and for competition, and an advanced hunting dog, just for a hunting dog, a sporting dog that is otherwise a family pet. It's not unusual for that training period to take 2 years. This bill, as it's written, will effectively limit the number of clients that I'm allowed to do business with at any given time, because it enumerates on the basis of whether or not they are sexually intact. There's no reason for that. There's no justification for it. If what we're trying to do is limit the number of puppies that are produced, then let's look at the number of puppies that are produced.
Thank you. And I'm going to need to ask you to wrap up your testimony. And I want to also let people know, if I did not get to you today, please submit written testimony if you'd like to have your testimony considered. You can do that right away, please. We're going to need to leave the room. There's another committee waiting to get in. I just wanted to ask the person from Washington to come up very briefly. Thank you for your testimony. Come up very briefly and answer the question about the USDA exemption, because we heard that Washington did pass a bill that had the USDA exception, and I wanted to get that on the record while you're here.
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm Jennifer Hillman with Humane Society of the United States.
Jennifer Hillman?
Hillman, H-I-L-L-M-A-N. The governor did just sign
just a minute, please. Can we have quiet for just a minute, please?
And we exempted USDA licensed breeders who had their license prior to the effective date of the act. Other than that, and that's about 7 months from now when it goes into effect. Other than that, no.
And how many USDA breeders were there that were accepted under the existing?
Well, we didn't. There are about five or six USDA licensed breeders currently in Washington State. I can get you the exact number, and I'd be happy to send a link to the bill and the bill report as well.
Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Thank you, everyone. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2470 and adjourning for the day.